Today's Teisho will be on case 45 in the Mumonka. Case 45 is Hoen's Who Is He? Hoen of Tozan said, "Even Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he?" Mumon's comment, "If you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it is like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not?" Mumon's verse, "Don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't discuss another's faults, don't explore another's affairs." I want to thank you all for coming to practice Zen this morning. I think that these Saturday sits are really quite wonderful. At the end of a very busy week with a lot of problems, I can become a little bit knotted up. Last week was just really intensely busy. And there were a number of issues that just come up, right? So it was a long week, a difficult week, and on a Friday afternoon, I heard somebody out in the office. We have a main office surrounded, a main reception area surrounded by offices. And I was in my office working, and the door was closed, and I have quite a good door. Really, people can't hear inside, and I can't hear outside. I was working at my word processor answering emails, and I could hear through this very heavy door somebody like yelling, screaming. And it was so loud and so distressed that I opened the door. And there was this very large student, a young man. He was probably a little taller than I am. And he's a handsome young man, big shoulders, bigger than I am. And he was in extreme distress because really yelling. He was saying, "I want to see the director. I want to see the director." My colleague Michael Goller came out of his office, and this young man said, "Are you the director? I want to see the director." And then he said my name. He said, "I want to see Kurt Spellmeyer." And so I came out and I said, "I'm Kurt Spellmeyer," and he was really like in extreme distress, really agitated and angry. And he was a little bit frightening, actually. He seemed furious and almost out of his mind. And a little bit frightening, So I said, "Listen, you can't keep yelling like that, or we'll have to ask you to leave the office. But if you want to come in and sit down, you can come in and sit down." So he came into my office and sat down. And I said, "What's the problem?" And it took him a while to work through his distress and his anger and to just tell me the story. He was just his mind was very scattered. And, it turns out that he had signed up for what we call an internship. He was doing an internship, that is, he had a job in the community in his area of expertise, which was computer programming. And the English department has internships where you can do this kind of work, but then you have to do some research on some aspect of that work. You have to read a certain number of articles and books, and then you have to write a 10-page paper, which looks at your work in some kind of a from some kind of intellectual perspective. But he had not understood the nature of the assignment. He had gone to his job and he had done more than 200 hours in his internship, but he hadn't kept up with his written work, and he didn't understand that he had to. And when he went to see the teacher had said, "You haven't kept up on your written work, you fail." So I have to admit that if that happened to me, I'd be hysterical too. So, you know, I thought the student was really done an injustice. And basically, I tried to get him to calm down, and I tried to assure him that he wasn't going to fail the course. I would make sure he didn't fail. I would give him the opportunity to do the work he hadn't done, and that it was absurd to think he'd have to do another 200 hours of work at another internship in order to finish this course, which was the last course he needed in order to graduate. And I felt so sorry for him. He was a big, strapping guy, and he actually was, you know, like crying. I had to bring in the handkerchiefs, you know, the Kleenexes for him, which I usually reserve for the young women who come in to cry. So this big, strapping guy was using Kleenexes, you know, to wipe his tears away. And he was shaking. He was so upset. And I felt he really had been wronged, you know. I felt he really had been done a... I think the teacher, who was a pretty good teacher, had made a terrible judgment. This had gotten under his skin somehow, you know. And this guy was really, like, enraged and crying and, you know. So anyway, I finally patched him up. I said, "Look, you know, I have a colleague. You can work with him. He will get you through." You know, he worked it all out, and then, you know, he got up, and he was still in kind of like a semi-shock state, you know, and I said, "I'm really sorry this happened to you. I think your teacher made a mistake, and you know, please forgive me, you know, that this happened." And you know, and I patted him on the back, and I sent him on his way. And anyway, you know, then I get a call from the teacher, and the teacher had some kind of a run-in with the student, and the teacher, I said, "Well, you know, I really think this guy should be allowed to finish. You know, he's done all this work and so on and so on." And the teacher said, "Well, I don't agree. You know, I think he's played fast and loose. You know, he's a con artist," and on and on. And so I finally got him to see that there wasn't any wisdom in making this kid suffer, even if he had been deceptive, that we might as well let him finish the work. If he didn't do the work, we'll let him finish the work. So anyway, then this teacher said, "Well, who's going to do the work with him?" And I said, "Well, actually, I was going to ask Mike to do it." And he said, "Well, I want to do it." You know, so the teacher got so upset, I thought he was going to become hysterical, you know. So I just said, look, you know, let me think about it. Let me sleep on it. You know, let's all just rest. Let's, you know, just, we have the weekend. We can think it over." And that was my way of really, like, I'm never going to call him back about the issue. I'm just going to go ahead and get the kid through, you know. So maybe I'll just leave it and, you know, he'll forget about it, or time will make it unimportant, you know. But I want to get this student through the course so he can graduate and go on with his life without hating Rutgers, right? So anyway, I have had a number of things like this. You know, so by the end of the day, my assistant said, "I'm out of here, I'm so burned out, you know." So anyway, when I come here to sit on a Saturday morning, I have these knots, you know, from the week. And we recite the sutras, and I feel a little better. And then we do the first three periods of meditation, and I feel a little better. You know, I can feel those knots sort of undoing, you know, like unknotting themselves. And then, you know, the last two sits are hard. You know, I've been doing this for 35 years, but, you know, sometimes sitting for five periods in a row is hard. You know, getting through those last two sits without moving, without undoing my legs is difficult. Every once in a while, my legs will start cramping, you know. And I have, you know, if I have a cramp, you know, I'm the teacher. I'm not supposed to move, you know. And I'm supposed to set a good example. So even though my leg might be cramping, I really don't want to move. So I just have to go into move. I have to go into deep concentration until the cramp goes away. And it can be done. I've done it hundreds of times. It's not pleasant. But you know, at the end of it all, I feel so good. I feel like every atom in my body has been scrubbed clean, you know. And so when I got up to do the meditation, the walking meditation, the Keenheen today, you know, I just felt like I was walking on air. This is such a beautiful feeling. I mean, I'm not boasting. You know, this will happen to anybody who does a lot of zazen. And when it happens, it's just so wonderful. It's liberation, right? It's liberation. So many of our problems, you know, are imaginary problems, or we're clinging to things that no longer are present. You know, so when I sat down on the cushion today, I just kept replaying the events of yesterday with this poor student, with the angry teacher, you know, and so on. And there were a number of these events during the week, you know. It just, any kind of human community is going to produce these tensions. It just does. And, you know, people are, so-and-so's mad at so-and-so. And I have two people who work for me. And they, you know, one person went to meet the other. One's on this campus, one is on College Avenue. The one from College Avenue came over here and said, you know, we've got a bad report on a teacher. The person over here who's in charge said, well, I think she's a good teacher. And they had a big fight, you know. And they each called me on the phone after the fight. One called me up and said, you won't believe what she did. Blah, 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 blah. And then the other called me and said, you won't believe what he did, right? So I just, each person, I just said, you're doing a very good job, you know, let me think about it. You know, let me think about it. I'm not sure what to do. I intend to do nothing, right? But I said, yes, yes, I hear you. You know, you're doing an excellent job. You know, you care, you're really concerned, which is true. And I said, let me think about what to do. And then, you know, same thing with the other person. And by the way, when I saw them later, they said, you don't have to do anything, really, just don't do anything. So they're getting a little bit more perspective on it, a little calmer, feel less hurt feelings, you know. So anyway, you know, all of this was with me when I sat down on the cushion. I'm all knotted up from, you know, trying to break up these fights, and it's the end of the semester, and people have all been working a little too much, a little too hard. And, you know, by the end of the 5 sits of meditation, I feel like I'm walking on air, you know. That is so wonderful. You know, for some reason, we just can't let it go. You know, we carry these things around. The event, the conflict between my two assistants took place on Wednesday. But today, Saturday morning, I'm still carrying it around in my head, you know. And the other conflict between the student and the teacher happened yesterday, but I'm still carrying it around in my head. You know, it's a great pity that we humans can't just let it go. You know, it's already gone, right? But we just keep reliving these events, and especially like traumatic events. But these weren't really traumas; they were just difficult. But I'm playing them again. I can't put them down. I can't put them down. And I think many of us are like this, right? You know. So anyway, I finally put them down, and it was like being young again. It was like being you know, free, like getting out of jail. This is really quite beautiful that we have this capacity to put it down. I think it's miraculous and wonderful, and I think it makes Zazen really quite special. You know, it's, I don't know of anything else that does this so effectively. You know, I have when I was a little kid, I went to a therapist, I mean a psychiatrist, actually. When I was a little kid, my parents took me to a psychiatrist. Later, I have been to a therapist. I have enjoyed the pleasures of drinking. I have enjoyed wine in my life. I have enjoyed marijuana. I have enjoyed other things too. And you know, some of them are quite good, but none of them let me free like this, you know? And it's nothing special. It's not about me. It's about Zazen. I think meditation is really quite unique in its ability to liberate us. And what really, and I'm not saying, by the way, that those other things aren't good. You know, they're really wonderful. I think all of those things in their proper place are useful and valuable and so on. But I just personally think that there's something special about Zazen which just wipes the slate clean. It's just like you're free. And it doesn't always happen, but when it happens, it's so wonderful to know that there's something that can actually do this. And it's all because of the power of this Mushin mind, you know, sitting in emptiness. You know, the problem with humans, and especially modern people, is we live so much in our heads. We live so much in a world of symbols and ideas and memories and so on. And it's depleting. It actually wears us down. You know, my assistant is a really brilliant young woman, and she's just a dynamo. I'm so lucky to have her in my office. I adore her. And her husband is this wonderful guy. They're a wonderful young couple, and she's just full of pep and energy. But at the end of the day, like any human being, she said, you know, I've had it. You know, enough is enough. You know, it wears us out. It wears us out to be under, under this sort of constant bombardment of information and so on. And we're reacting emotionally to everything that's going on. You know, the Zen ideal is basically to have an empty head and be very alive. When you're no longer overwhelmed by all these inputs, especially by concepts and our tendency to cling, you know, there's suddenly all this energy at your disposal that you don't normally have, because we're holding on, mentally holding on to everything, you know. And so, you know, the Zen ideal is like somebody who is not thinking, but who's very alive, very spontaneous and alive. That's what Zen training is trying to produce, is a person like that who is walking around with an empty head, basically, without a lot of ideation going on, but very responsive, very very alive, in an emotional sense too. You know, and that's not the normal condition of most human beings, but with Zazen, it's quite possible to be like that. You know, so you're able to respond quickly to things and humanely, because you're not being driven by compulsions, you know. And it's the power of emptiness that allows this to happen, the power of emptiness. But, you know, there's a deeper dimension to this. There's a deeper dimension to this, which I think is really quite, quite important, you know. I had an interesting experience yesterday morning before I went to work and encountered the screaming student. Yesterday was Friday, and I don't teach on Friday. I have to do work in my office, but I don't teach. And I realized when I looked at my calendar that I didn't have any meetings either in the morning. Usually I have either meetings or teaching or a meeting with teachers or something. But I was free. So as I was driving into work, I drive down in South Plainfield. I drive past my doctor's office every day, Dr. Gandotra. His name is Satya Gandotra. And I drive by his office every day anyway. And I was driving by his office, and it was 9 o'clock. And I thought, why don't I just go in and get my flu shot? And so I also have like this chronic vitamin B12 shortage. So I was going to get my flu shot and a B12 shot. And so I pulled him into the office, and I went in, and I there behind the desk was his assistant, his receptionist. And I said, listen, I don't have an appointment, but I wonder if you could work me in. Could you give me a flu shot and a vitamin B12 shot? And she said, yes, we can do that. And I said, but what? And I said, is Dr. Gandotra here? And she said, Dr. Gandotra died 3 weeks ago. And I was just stunned. Dr. Gandotra has been my doctor for 18 years. So since I was 39 years old, yeah. He was a wonderful man. I knew he had, about 3 or 4 years ago, he had cancer. And he lost all his hair because he was going through chemo. And he had to maintain his medical practice. You know, I must say that's so difficult, right? I mean, if I were to get cancer in my job, you know, I could stay home and somebody else would do my job while I was away, and I wouldn't lose my paycheck or anything. I might have to go on disability, but usually in my department we don't even do that. We just stay home until we're better. But he was a independent physician. He had an office, and he had people counting on him. And he didn't have a partner. He wasn't part of a group. So, you know, when he got cancer, he had to come in, you know, every day and still do his medical practice, or he was basically broke, right? So, you know, while he was going through chemo, he was still carrying his medical practice. And then his hair all fell out, and then it came back, and he was doing so much better. A couple of years ago, he just seemed to be flourishing. I was so happy. And we had these wonderful conversations. You know, he was a yoga practitioner, and he was like a devout Hindu. You know, he was he would go to these ashram yoga center for a week and do like a yoga retreat. And he loved them. He kept saying, when I retire, I'm going to just go and live at, you know, Kripalu, you know, forever, a place like that. I just thought he was the most wonderful man. And I would come into his office sometime, and the room was just full of basically old sick people. You know, I'd come in and the place was packed, and everybody looked like they were on their last legs, you know. The people who were elderly, sick, you know, people with respirators, you know, people with on crutches, you know, that was his life, helping all these people. And he was such a good man, you know. It was a real shock to see him gone, but you know, he was such an exemplary human being. He really. He got there at 8:30 in the morning, and he must have gone home at 6 or 7 at night, seeing all these people who were in dire straits, you know. And I know that he had found in himself this kind of this radiant compassion, you know, which he carried with him through the day. You know, he did his yoga, and I did my meditation. And he tried to do yoga every morning, you know, before the sun came up. Just like, you know, I would get up, and we were both vegetarians. And he would try to get up before the sun came up and do his yoga. And I get up before the sun comes up, and I do my zazen, you know. And I think he really was in touch with that. You know, when we're caught up in all of our mental baggage, all of our ghosts are driving us. You know, we can't necessarily be responsive and compassionate. But you know, if we can sweep all that away, if we can get to that place where it all lifts, you know, and we feel like we're walking on air, you know, it's possible to respond to the world in this very generous way, because we're not being weighed down, and we're not reacting defensively to things. It's just if you're whole and you're happy, it's very easy to be generous, you know. And actually, being whole and happy is the best possible state to be in, you know. And generosity is like so natural in that condition. It's much harder to be generous when we're terrified or we're insecure. It's possible to do that, but it's very difficult. So I think somebody like Dr. Gandotra was really like an exemplary human being. I think he had really found that place inside of himself that was, you know, luminous and compassionate and open, like the sky. And I think he really tried to make his life a kind of practice. You know, that was his devotional practice, was taking care of these endless numbers of sick people. So, you know, I think that what we're doing is really quite important. You know, I believe that there's a dimension to this which is, you know, there's like self-help, or there's a dimension to this which is self-healing, right? You know, we get knotted up and we come in and we sit down on the cushion, and if we're in a lot of distress, it's hard to be helpful. Like, you know, when that student came into my office, you know, I was a neutral party, you know. I wasn't in caught up in the matter, and I could be generous to him because I wasn't invested in the case. But I've been mad at students myself, you know. I've had students who have driven me right up the wall, you know. And I don't think I could behave so well because, you know, maybe they touched a nerve in me that didn't allow me to respond in the best possible way. Didn't allow me to respond from the best of myself, you know, if that makes any sense. So I think being able to get in touch with this part of ourselves which is open and bright and inherently generous is really quite important, you know. And I think when we fail to do that, it's quite important also. You know, it's really quite a problem. You know, yesterday afternoon, I finished grading some papers, and it was the end of the day, and my assistant had left, and I was sitting in my office, and my brain was so drained that I just wanted to read the newspaper. So I went online and I was reading like the Daily Beast and the Huffington Post and having a cup of coffee, because I wanted to come over here, of course, at 7 o'clock and have our evening meditation. And I was reading this essay that was really quite alarming. I think it was in the Daily Beast, but it was about an Indian journalist who was writing about going to a classroom in somewhere in India. I can't remember where it was, but I think it was near Bangalore, believe it or not. And he said he was stunned by what happened in the classroom, because the teacher asked the students, and there were like 25 students in this classroom, to name a person they thought was exemplary or really admirable. And only one student in the class said Gandhi. And like eight or nine students said Hitler. Right? And this journalist just didn't know what to do. You know, he thought, what? You know, like, I can't be hearing this right. Hitler. And they all said, oh yes, you know, he was a strong leader. And so the journalist started doing some research, and he found that Mein Kampf, Hitler's book, actually is in wide circulation in India. And that there is an Indian political leader who recently died named Bal Thackeray, who was a big admirer of Hitler. And basically, Thackeray is a very vehement, vicious, like anti-Muslim politician. And Hitler was his inspiration. You know, so this was like astonishing to this journalist, you know. And he wrote the rest of the article is just about this this development in India. And I thought to myself, you know, here in India we think of as this is the home of the Buddha, right? This is where the Buddha was born. Also, Gandhi, you know, somebody I admire so much and the West admires so much with his teaching of ahimsa, of nonviolence, comes from India. And India has this long tradition of, you could say, spiritual cultivation, the teaching of compassion, you know, a reverence for wisdom. You know, you have a great... great Buddhist saints who came from India, Hindu saints, Muslim saints, great Sufi teachers. And in the midst of all of this wisdom is this terrible, terrible ignorance, this terrible cruelty. And it's like, how can this be? You know, one kid in the class said, when the journalist asked the students why they didn't say Gandhi, a number of students said they thought Gandhi was a coward because he didn't believe in fighting. And I was just stunned. I thought, how can this be in India of all places? But I think there's a really important truth here, you know, you know, basically, when we cling too much to identity, you know, to identity, to this world of ideas and this world of, the world we in Buddhism we say the world of form, we can become very deformed as human beings, very distorted as human beings. In India, there has been an increasing tension, I think, between people who define themselves as Hindus and people who define themselves as Muslims. You know, and there are people who really are called Hindu nationalists who really believe that in some essential way they are Hindus, and in some essential way, you know, this makes them special. Now, you know, my doctor, Dr. Gandotra, was a wonderful Hindu, you know, incredibly kind, compassionate. He saw giving as his mission in life, you know. And he had, when he talked about doing yoga, he had real joy. You know, and he, by the way, he admired Gandhi. You know, Gandhi was one of his heroes. On the other hand, you have somebody like Val Thackeray, who says, you know, the Hindu reality is the best reality, the only reality, and the Hindus are best people, and so on. This idea of clinging to an identity is. This clinging to an identity is really very bad, really destructive to human beings because it makes you darker, you know, frankly. You know, when you live that way, you become darker and darker, right, inside yourself. You know, and your response is more and more fearful and aggressive, you know. And so, I think, basically, that when we sit down on the cushion, and we watch the breath and we enter mushin, you know, we're doing something very, very important. You know, our teacher, Rinzai Linji, said that when we do meditation, we encounter what Linji called the man of no, with no rank, the person of with no rank. This is like a metaphor for this bright, compassionate, formless energy, you know, that we encounter sometimes when we sit on the cushion. In that state, in that condition, there is no such thing as a Buddhist. There is no such thing as a Jew or a Christian. There is no such thing as Hindu or a Muslim. We respond to the world without, without those labels, without we respond directly from this luminous, compassionate energy, which is at the core of our being, at the core of our being. And I think this is what Zen is all about, is producing a person who is capable of responding to life with a kind of unreflecting compassion, unreflecting generosity, a fearless, loving kindness. Yeah. And I think that condition is most easy to realize, that kind of generosity is most easy to realize when you're in that empty, luminous state. And so then you're just acting naturally in this kind way. And I think that when we don't cultivate this formless aspect of ourselves, we can become very distorted as human beings. Very distorted. You know, when we cling to form, when we cling to some kind of an idea, or some kind of, especially ideas about identity, you know, we close off we close ourselves off to what is best in ourselves. We close off access to this luminous, compassionate energy. And we become, you know, we become like bad people. And I would say that somebody like Thackeray in India has done unbelievable damage to humanity because of his mistake. And so, you know, there's a lot at stake in what we're doing on the cushion. I think that the only hope for human beings is to be able to get to this place where these kinds of differences don't matter, you know, because our response is naturally compassionate. And I have known many people who have, I believe, realized that condition of sort of like unreflecting compassion. I think, I can't help but think that, you know, my Zen training has made me more sensitive to people's suffering. I really believe that. You know, I got up on Friday and did my Zazen, you know, before I got in my car and went to the doctor. And, you know, when I encountered that student, I really felt my heart was like breaking. Because of his suffering, you know. And I wasn't trying to be compassionate. I just think I just felt very open to his unhappiness, you know. And I think that's a good place to be. It takes a lot of work for people to be like that. So this koan is really quite important. Hoan's, who is he? Hoan of Tozan said, even the Buddha and Maitreya, the Buddha of the present age and the Buddha of the to come, there's a future Buddha who's coming, in theory, whose name is Maitreya. Even Shakyamuni, the Buddha, and Maitreya are servants of another. And I want to ask you, who is he? And this koan is really saying, have you gotten in touch with that open blue sky part of yourself, which is instinctively loving and instinctively open and compassionate? That part of yourself has no name, it has no birthday, it isn't Muslim, it isn't Buddhist, it isn't it has none of those features, right? And I really think this is like the hope of humanity, is being able to get in touch with this. So please don't think that meditation practice is just about feeling good. You know, I think there's a great deal more at stake than that. You know, I don't know if you have been following our meditation group's Facebook page, but you might not even know we have a Facebook page. And I myself am not a fan of Facebook, I have to say. But it turns out that one member of our group has learned that my teacher, my first teacher, Genki Roshi, really wasn't an exemplary monk in a lot of ways. She discovered that he had been involved in a couple of sexual scandals. One when he was training at a major Zen training center called Daitokuji. He had had an affair with a woman, and she became pregnant, and he refused to marry her. And that destroyed his reputation. And then when he was here in the United States and teaching at the Seattle Zen Center, he had had an affair with one of his students who also became pregnant. And now, you know, when this information came to light, I was really quite surprised, because I didn't know that any of this had happened at the Zen Center. Basically, I came to the Zen Center to do Zazen, and I really didn't pay much attention to anything else. I was very busy, and I came in and sat, and I went back to graduate school and tried to figure out Heidegger, things like that, somewhat unsuccessfully. So, I didn't get wind of any of this. But I still love my teacher, Genki Roshi. I think that he was a human being, and that we all have the potential to be like Gandhi or Bal Thackeray, you know? We all all of those things are inside us. There is a Gandhi inside us, and there is a Bal Thackeray in every one of us. There is a Hitler in every one of us. That is not a metaphysical proposition, it's a fact, you know. And my teacher was not as bad as Hitler. In his worst aspects, he was kind of selfish, and he was irresponsible and childish sometimes. But he also had this capacity to be very nurturing and protective, especially of his students, believe it or not. So, you know, Genki Roshi was like a human being. He was a combination of this extraordinary capacity for compassion and selfishness, you know, that could be sometimes quite surprising. You know? So these two things were mixed up in the same person. You know, I didn't really know about his affair. I didn't know about that, and I'm very sorry that that happened. But in so many ways I can think of his kindness to me and his encouragement. And it doesn't make the bad things, he doesn't excuse the mistakes he made, but I just think there's a complex picture. You know, and we're all like this. We all have to. I think it's important to do something like Zazen. I mean, obviously Zazen is my path in life. But you know, when I sit down on the cushion, I don't just get rid of my stress and my knots. I also confront my failures for the day, you know? So, you know, when I sit down on the cushion, sometimes I realize, you know, maybe I've had a fight with my wife, and I realize I made a big mistake. I shouldn't have said that to her, that I hurt her feelings. You know, maybe in anger, you might say something to someone you love, and then later you realize, my God, did I say that? I caused her so much pain. Or, maybe in your job you do something that causes somebody pain, and because you're angry at the time or you're frightened, you don't think about it. But when you sit down on the cushion, sometimes sitting down on the cushion means facing things we've done. Having to come face to face with our mistakes. And that's very difficult, but it's really a crucial aspect of Zen practice, And, we realize perhaps that we've done something wrong, that we've done something that hurt somebody, and we feel remorse, and then it's possible even to forgive ourselves, And so, loving kindness is actually, it's possible to experience loving kindness directed at yourself, in spite of your mistakes, and this is quite an important practice. So anyway, Hoan of Tozan said, "Even Shakyamuni Buddha and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? Have you gotten in contact with that bright mind, that luminous loving kindness inside yourself?" Mumon's comment: if you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it's like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not? In other words, you realize this is your true nature. When we talk about true nature in Zen, we really mean this. Mumon's verse: don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't discuss another's faults, don't explore another's affairs. So, when we enter into that state of formless compassion, we understand that everything is part of ourselves. We have a kind, don't take this the wrong way, but we are kind of responsible for everything. That doesn't mean we're guilty of mistakes that others have made, but it means that we have a responsibility to be constantly taking care of the world, constantly taking care of other people. That's the attitude. Constantly, it's like you need to be like a grandmother to everybody, It's actually, in the sutras, this is actually called grandmotherly kindness. You need to show grandmotherly kindness to everybody. It's not easy, but that's the ideal.